Stem cell science is changing medicine and our understanding of human development. Learn more with the Stem Cell Channel. Visit uctv.tv/stemcell.
Welcome to A Closer Look. I'm Rob Signer, Deputy Director of the Sanford Stem Cell Discovery Center and Associate Professor in the Division of Regenerative Medicine at UC San Diego. Now, when you or someone you love is facing a serious or life-threatening illness, it can feel like the world has closed in. The treatments you've tried may no longer be working, and the future can feel uncertain. In those moments, it's natural to wonder, is there anything else out there that can make a difference? The answer, more often than people realize, is yes. Every single day, scientists and physicians are testing new therapies that have the potential to change lives. Clinical trials are where hope meets science, where medicine takes bold steps forward, the place where patients can access tomorrow's cures today. Every day, new therapies are being tested that could change the future of how we treat cancer, regenerate tissues, and extend healthy lives. For families searching for answers, this program is about finding light in the darkest times and seeing that science is not standing still. In every clinical trial, there is the possibility of rewriting what's possible in medicine, and that possibility could be life-changing. Today, we'll hear from two physicians who are leading the way in this work. They'll explain what clinical trials are, how to navigate them, and share insights into some of the most groundbreaking research, including trials harnessing the power of stem cells and tackling cancers that once seemed untreatable. Now, if you ever wondered whether a trial might hold answers for you or a loved one, you won't want to miss this conversation as we take a closer look at stem cells and clinical trials. Please welcome Dr. Morris.
Thank you so much, Rob, for having us speak today. It's a real honor to do so. Here's a little bit of clinical trials 101 now. What is a clinical trial? Maybe many of you already know this, but I thought we should just go over that so everybody's on that same page. First off, you know, it's good to note that research like this is highly regulated and overseen. There's a code of federal regulations that define what research is. So research is a systemic investigation, including research development, testing, and evaluation designed to develop or contribute to generalizable knowledge. Now, we also can define people that do, you know, people that participate in research. So nowadays, we tend to call people participants, but going back in the CFRs, they still refer to people as human subjects. It's sort of an older term that you'll still come across. And you know, as they define that, as someone that's participating in the study is a living individual about whom an investigator conducts research. And this can be obtaining information, biospecimens through intervention or interaction with the individual and uses, studies, or analyzes information or biospecimens, or obtains, uses, studies, analyzes, or generates identifiable private information or identifiable biospecimens. What the important takeaway from that is that human research includes just using the data that has been derived from somebody. It can be just using their specimens. So it encompasses all those pieces, not just the person that's walking in and actually getting like that treatment, say from in a clinical trial. And there are different kinds of research. Obviously, we're really talking about medical and clinical trials today, but you can also do just behavioral studies, behavioral interventions, qualitative work. We can also get epidemiological studies, which really try to look at the incidence of diseases, prevalence of diseases. And getting to how they're regulated, that we often have to abide by, you know, certain, you know, ethical principles. These are sort of based a lot on the Belmont Report of 1979. They've actually been modified a little bit by then, but they basically still have these three principles about respect for persons, which is really about people are going to participate in a study voluntarily. They're going to have an informed consent, and they're going to be allotted the privacy and confidentiality that they need and that through the different regulations and bodies that govern this. Beneficence is about doing good or doing, you know, it also refers to not doing any harm. So it's key that there's a, you know, we used to talk about the risk benefit ratio for a study and that it needs to be favorable. Justice refers to, you know, the people that that our participating study should also be the people that might in the future, or at least people like them, that would be benefit from the results of the study. And what this all means is generally that that research that is done on humans that needs to be usually approved and reviewed by somebody like an institutional review board, whether that's at our institution like UC San Diego or some sort of centralized IRB. But all research is overseen and approved for their ability to do that research. So what's a clinical trial then? Clinical trial is a research study involving human subjects to evaluate health-related interventions. So, and the goals there are to assess safety and effectiveness of treatment, but you can also usually have some sort of comparator, you know, compared to a new or existing treatment or maybe standard care. It might also explore, you know, different kinds of fields like prevention, diagnostics, or, you know, some sort of treatment or other management considerations. So we often talk about phases of clinical trials, and you may have heard this, and I just wanted to clarify what those are. So phase 1, 2, 3 are the main ones. Phase 1 is where we are, that first in human study, and that usually means we're really just making sure that that drug is going to be safe in humans and determining what dose is safe to move forward to further studies. We may get some signal of efficacy here, but mainly we're just looking at, it's a single arm study. There's no comparator here. It's just that drug in ascending dose or product in ascending in some way to make sure that it is tolerable and safe to proceed to another level to maybe check their efficacy. And that's where we get to phase 2 and 3 studies. And all the way, we're always looking for safety signal. We're always looking for adverse events. The phase 2 study is that first study that you're trying to look for effectiveness and that you're having a comparator arm. And the key here in a phase 2 is you're really trying to say that if someone took the product perfectly, would it work? And so you tend to do what we call an as-treated type of analysis. So people that actually got product are the people that you're looking at. And then when you get to phase 3, it's a bigger study. It's meant to be usually this pivotal study that may be used for FDA approval. And that phase 3 study is more about generalizability. So there we use something called intention to treat. It means that anybody that got product or was assigned to that product arm is counted as having taken it. Even if they didn't take it or they had side effects, the idea is there is that if you gave this out as a prescription, would it still be effective for the target population? And then phase 4 is just sort of following up in terms of refining that product, getting more data on it, and maybe checking how it might work in different types of the disease. So I'm going to move on to sort of what that basic clinical trial looks like, straight from my lecture materials. So usually what we're doing is we're picking a sample population, usually defined by specific inclusion-exclusion criteria that you've predetermined for your study. And then you're assigning them to get product and then some comparator. In this case, this is the placebo. So placebo is a product that looks like the product that we're of interest, but has no active ingredient in it. And then basically those people get treated. And then in a follow-up time, we're looking at whether there was, a change in their status of disease in the two groups and comparing it. There's a few terms, though, that you might have heard that you might want to know about. And that includes, the idea of randomization. So why do we randomize? We always talk about that. So randomization means that people are being assigned to their arm by chance, and it could be 1-to-1, it could be 2-to-1. You can change that randomization scheme. Why do we do it? Is because it allows you to allocate at random other factors that may relate to the outcome that are unrelated to the treatment. So you're trying to balance out what we call confounding factors, and that the only real thing that you're really manipulating is that treatment versus compared, and that comparator could be maybe another drug that's best on the market, or it may be standard of care, or maybe it's a placebo. And then you might have heard the term blinding. So what does blinding mean? Blinding means that you don't know what that assignment is. And you can have single, double, triple blinding, meaning whether the The investigator may not know what the product that the person's getting. The person may not know what they're getting. And the assessors may not know what the product was given. So that allows, again, for another level so that there's no bias in people assigning people to, attributes that they, because they think it should work, for example. So how do you get into a clinical trial? Here at the clinical center, we have a website, the stemcells.ucsd.edu, and that can lead you to where our studies are, our current disease. There's a whole list of them. You can click on them, and that'll tell you what study we have and a contact for that study. We also have a general contact for the clinic, and we have, for those times you don't have a study that really may apply to you, we also have what we've developed as a registry so people can put their name down, tell them what they're interested in, and then we're going to keep tabs on that. And then what we're planning is to have a regular send out of updates of current studies and what studies have just opened, so maybe they can then participate at that point. Then we have a phone number and both and then of course the email that you can reach us at. The other thing is, if you're a UC San Diego patient, on MyChart, you can actually click on that you want to participate in studies. And so you can go to your MyChart and there's a research button and you can push that button and then go to that I'm interested and then people will contact you if they get searched for a particular term or type of disease. And then there's the more general. You want to find any study that's available maybe in the country. And this is where clinicaltrials.gov is very useful. Every legitimate type study is supposed to be registered on clinicaltrials.gov, a website that's run by NIH, and also they keep track of that and making sure that results get entered. And you can actually put in condition and location, and it'll come up with a list of studies that are open, that are enrolling, where they are and what the contact is. And that's another way to really look out. I mean, obviously there's other ways you can find trials through support groups, et cetera, but these are some of the more common ways that I would suggest in terms of general ways that you can get in touch with them. With that, I was going to pivot to Dr. Patel. He's going to tell you more about the studies that we're doing and see some of the exciting opportunities that are there.
Thank you, Dr. Morris. And so I'm really privileged to work with an amazing team. It takes a village to put these trials together. And many of these are discoveries from clinic, from the lab, the bench that are being taken into the clinic in the context of these CIRM-funded studies. And so this is just a snapshot of the types of studies that we do. Not that you have to go through every single line, but there's just a wide breadth of the types of studies that we do, ranging from neurodegenerative disease, inborn errors in metabolism, advanced tumors, including multiple different tumor types, rheumatologic disease. And so really the potential for regenerative medicine cuts across all disease states. And that's one of the most interesting and promising parts of our work is our ability to really just impact human health across multiple different modalities. As mentioned, it takes a village. And so these are the folks who have expertise throughout the various different disease states and around on our inpatient service. Many of these treatments, in fact, have a level of toxicity that requires inpatient monitoring in the hospital. We try to make that as seamless as possible between our inpatient unit as well as KOP. And you see some of the folks that make that happen here, in addition to our wonderful APPs who really act as liaisons to make sure we have good continuity of care for our patients. As mentioned, there's a variety of different clinical trials that we offer across different disease states. One of the ones that's been really exciting has been NRTX1001. It's a GABAergic cell therapy. It's actually injected into the brain. So part of the team is, in fact, the surgeons who do the procedures and the neurologists who help us manage, the immunotherapists who actually help us manage the immunosuppression. And here you see the number of seizures on the y-axis, and you see one of the patients, purple, but several others as well. They all have a decrease in the number of seizures that they have, some going from multiple refractory seizures to zero seizures. You see blue, red, green, very close to zero, 100% reduction. And so here we're restoring function of the off-pathway neurons, which are GABAergic, and thus reducing epilepsy, right? And so this really is one of the exciting areas we can really improve on human health. And it takes a village, right, ranging from surgeons to neurologists, immunotherapists, to make a positive impact for these patients. Spinal cord injury is something near and dear to many. In fact, there's a whole center going up at the VA across the street from us nationally. That'll be a spinal cord center of excellence. And here is a surgical device that's being implanted that delivers oligodendrocyte progenitor cells. So it's a cellular therapy. It's a living drug. It's administered directly into the spinal cord to try to stimulate some of these neurons to grow and form those connections that hopefully decrease the loss of motor activity that these folks have, and maybe lead to improvements in the ability to walk and feel again. And so these are types of therapies we're excited about. As you've seen with both these, though, there are surgical interventions required. So it isn't as simple as just taking a pill or getting an IV infusion. These have to be administered exactly to where the issue is. And here, both these are surgical approaches. Speaking of multidisciplinary collaborations, while chimeric antigen receptor T cell therapy has, in the current FDA approved state, is mainly around treatment of liquid tumors, for example, acute lymphoblastic leukemia, diffuse large B cell lymphoma, what about using this same technology to eradicate HIV, a viral infection? Now, while these HIV and AIDS can be controlled with oral regimens, even prevented with novel, recently approved agents, for those patients that already have HIV, can we eradicate this disease once and for all? And can a cellular therapy help us do that? And this is a trial that Dr. Morris leads at our site, where we make CAR T cells for that patient and then administer them back to the patient. And so Dr. Morris and Dr. Smith have been very involved in this modality. And yet again, a technology that's historically used for cancer being utilized to try to better health in folks with HIV and AIDS. Speaking of cancer, are there novel ways for us to utilize anti-cancer cellular immunotherapies? I mentioned in liquid tumors such as leukemias and lymphomas and myeloma, we use cell therapy. What about solid tumors, which are much more common? Here is an approach by A2 Bio, which tries to avoid the friendly fire of CAR T cell therapy. This has been the real barrier in solid tumors, where low-level expression of the antigen on normal cells is a barrier to administering the agent, for example, for mesothelin. Here, we use the HLA2 heterozygosity as a kind of a checkpoint, not immune checkpoint like PD-1 or CTLA-4, but a way for the cell to pass over the self cell and mainly attack the tumor, which is flagged by this loss of heterozygosity. Now, it turns out loss of heterozygosity can be anywhere from 10 to a third of patients, and it's across different tumor types, including some of the most difficult to treat tumors, pancreatic cancer, lung cancer, esophageal cancer, ranging all the way to colorectal cancer. And so this is a pan-cancer target potentially that we can try to help these patients. Another area that we're really excited about, and we're talking about CAR T cells, is if we can deplete B cells, whether they be the B cells that cause, let's say, acute lymphoblastic leukemia, what if we can use CAR T cells against those very B cells that cause multiple sclerosis, for example, in patients who are refractory to immunosuppression? So this is one of the latest trials we've opened with AZER-Z, which is a CD19 CAR T cell. And the idea here is with a single dose of cell therapy. This isn't an infusion you have to come in every couple weeks or a pill you have to take every day, but a single dose of treatment, you can eradicate all your autoreactive B cells that are causing your multiple sclerosis, and hopefully then just be able to remain in remission from multiple sclerosis without any treatment, further treatment required. And so this is an area we're very excited about and represents the type of therapy and type of clinical trial we really want to bring from the bench to the bedside to help our patients. And so, as mentioned earlier, it takes a village. And so these are the faces, and you saw some of the names earlier that helped put these grants together, help take care of these patients in the clinic. And if you have any questions, our amazing program lead and the Administrative Director of the Institute, Jameson Languth, whose email is here, you can contact and he can get you in touch with the right folks for a particular given clinical trial. Or if there's a clinical trial you hear about that's in this realm that you want us to deploy, we're always keen to work with our local industry partners, work with CIRM to make sure that we can take care of all our patients. And with that, happy to hand it over to Dr. Signer. Thank you.
We're going to take questions from the audience as well, but I thought maybe I could get us started a little bit. So
Dr. Morris, you talked about, you know, going to the website, going to clinicaltrials.gov, but, you know, there are people out there that really know nothing about clinical trials. They might be hearing about it for the first time. Where do they start beyond just going to a website? You know, I've been to clinicaltrials.gov and I've typed things in and you can get sort of an overwhelming list of things. So who do they talk to? Where do they start to ask questions? How do they go about doing that?
Sure. You know, the first thing you do is talk to your physician, probably, they may have an idea, although I would say that, you know, the average clinician may not be aware of most clinical trials that are happening, but that's always a good first step, and to discuss with them if that's a good idea for you. Once there, you know, the next step is usually the clinical trials are being run through, well, there's various things, but academic medical centers such as the universities are usually the people doing those studies. And that's probably another place where, you know, you can try to, get some more information, get a referral. The other place is, you know, you may have a specific disease and go to your support group and you want to ask other people. What do they know? You know, where are they going? What are their connections? There's often people that have the same sort of interest that you do, and are going to have already explored some other avenues that might be available. So just ask around, and I think you wanted to be I think I'd really advise if you're wanting to find something, you got to just keep digging for possibilities, then you might land to a place that where, you know, I know clinicaltrials.gov can be overwhelming because a lot of studies may be closed or only in follow-up and not enrolling, and then that can be frustrating not to find something that interests you.
So, you know, you mentioned that a lot of these are happening within academic medical centers, and, you know, we're fortunate here to be sitting in this great academic medical center, but lots of people aren't seen in those types of places, or they live in more rural locations. So, Dr. Patel, how would those patients or their families go about trying to, you know, get there? Are they just out of luck? Is there opportunity for them to be seen? How does it work in communication between hospitals and other settings? And then even beyond that, like, what about outside of the country, right? Are there mechanisms to help those patients as well?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think when we think about CIRM-powered studies, especially for California, really the mission is around serving the entire state. And so we have close collaborations with Eisenhower Medical Center, for example, in Riverside County here at UC San Diego, El Centro Regional Medical Center, and in even other parts of the county, Alvarado Medical Center, for example, and so which is now our East Campus. And so the idea that you can get that second opinion, especially now with telemedicine, if you're unable to commute, is definitely an opportunity as well. But the goal is to offer the studies to as many places as possible so patients don't have to have that burden of traveling. Your point about international is very well taken. There are international medicine services. In fact, I just got an email to do an international e-consult. And so there are mechanisms for this, but it gets complicated in terms of delivering treatment. And so in the same way we have to make medical decisions on personalizing therapy, we also have to think about the social and the context in terms of geography as well, in terms of what we can deliver. And then other aspects like having a caregiver, right? For some of these drugs have toxicities that can happen at the home, and making sure that they're able to have someone who can take care of them. And so I think to your point is very well taken that there are disparities in terms of clinical trials. Telemedicine helps us bridge some of those. Our partnerships with regional health systems helps us mitigate some of those. But at the end of the day, it takes a village to take care of these patients, and trying to be your own advocate, because there may not be a trial for you today, but in 6 months there may be because of the advent and the pace of medical discovery.
And then, you know, for each type of disease or disorder, there might be many different clinical trials ongoing with different targets. How do you navigate as a patient, you know, which would be the right one for you, right? Sharing a personal story here, I know someone who, you know, was fighting a type of cancer and their physician recommended a trial that they had ongoing there. And, you know, they asked me to read it, and the trial was really focused on one specific target. And I asked them, well, is there any evidence that you have this target? Like, is this actually going to be the right trial to help you? And I, you know, most people, I think, don't necessarily know to look for those things or how they navigate it. So how do you, just beyond finding a trial or getting involved in one, how do you identify the one that, like, you really think, or, you know, your care team really thinks has the potential to help you?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think to start, you know, you wouldn't climb a mountain without a Sherpa, right? And so you really need to rely on your physician who's been taking care of you to help kind of point you at least in the right direction. I do think usually there are multiple trials for a patient, right? And that's the good news if you're eligible for multiple trials. And then the question is which one. Now, more often than not, it's not A versus B, meaning like you have to pick A or B, meaning if A doesn't work, you can go to B, right? Or if B doesn't work, it's just really a sequencing question for the vast majority of these studies. But to your point, they're clinical trials, and so it's not as if even on the physician side, we know how to weigh the likelihood of success compared to standard of care treatment. All those statistics we talk about in the standard of care setting are actually derived from the clinical trial. And so when the clinical trial is ongoing, we really don't have a great sense of statistics. But I think you get to the point, what are some things to look for? My advice, one, your point about a targeted therapy, do you have the target? Is it testable? Are you able to test for it? Two, does the trial have a placebo, right? Maybe you have the target, but you're randomized to placebo. And then B, if there is a placebo on the study, you know, is it standard of care? Is it a true placebo? When, if the cancer or disease progresses, can you cross over to the treatment? These are some of the important questions, I think, to think about from a patient-centric view as I'm thinking, how do I approach a clinical trial?
And so then, like, are there, beyond your own care team, are there services out there to help patients and their families navigate these types of things? Does that exist?
I have not really heard of one of those that would really help navigate what the best trial is for them. I think that the best approach, too, is not to always stop at the first bus stop or the first specialist that you see. You might want to ask for other opinions and see different people, and then you get, and then that right round out sort of the decision-making process.
Absolutely. I think Dr. Morris mentioned earlier the patient advocacy groups, which are often online, can be really good resources, right? Because especially if you have a rare disease, you may be the only person in the county, right, who has that rare disease. But if you're linked with folks across the country or across the world, you start to get a better sense about who are the experts in that disease. Maybe you meet a couple of them. And what are the trials that folks are most enthused by? And so I do think trying to find that sense of community in your disease, especially for those folks who have rare tumors or rare diseases, I think makes sense. I wouldn't say there's a single search, you know, engine or AI tool or anything like that that I've found to be particularly effective, because the issue is with these tools, it's garbage in, garbage out, right? And so if the website on clinicaltrials.gov hasn't been updated in 3 months, then you're dealing with information 3 months ago, which for some diseases, right, is just not a length of time that's meaningful. Or there could be updates to the protocol. And so I think having those discussions, and as you're looking, let's say, for a trial that's of interest, if you scroll to the very bottom of clinicaltrials.gov, it tells you where the trial is open. And in fact, sometimes it lists the PI and their contact information. And so there may be one who's close to you. We showed our site earlier, Dr. Morris, for our trials. But the flip side, maybe you find a trial of interest from a patient advocacy group and you find that the closest site is, you know, in Denver, right, or in Phoenix or in LA. You can find on the website and contact them that way as well.
And would you advocate for patients to reach out to the PIs of those trials directly?
Absolutely. I think you have nothing to lose. It's an email or a phone call. And the honest truth of it is the sites want you on the study as much as you want to be on the study, right? Because we're trying to answer a question. And I think for those of us in academia, we want to be at the leading edge of medicine. And the way we do that is with clinical trials. And so you'll find people, like, if you think it's like a link to the ether, but actually you'll get a private response in a day or two to any email you send, because those sites are motivated to help you too.
I think that's really valuable information for people that they probably, you know, might be hesitant to do something like that, but that can really make a big difference there. So from an accessibility standpoint, right, like let's say you find a trial, you want to get on a trial, who pays for that trial? Is that the patient's responsibility? Is it covered by insurance? is, you know, Medicare, Medicaid, is the trial have funding that pays for that? How does that work?
Well, it could be all of the above. I think that most, if it's, like cancer studies are known to be sort of a blend of both insurance and sponsor being usually who is paying for the study. It could be NIH, it could be a pharmaceutical company. So most of the costs usually are paid for inside the actual trial itself. Now it gets tricky if it's relying on insurance, because then you know the facility you're going to, whether they take your insurance might matter in that case. So that's kind of less than you know desirable in terms of making it accessible to everybody. The best case is where it's fully paid for. And now the one thing is about it, it does need to be disclosed about what the cost might be to the patient. This is one, that's one of the things that is scrutinized by the IRB in the consent and in the protocol. If there are costs that could be, you know, to have a burden for the patient, that they need to be aware of that. So I, you know, I'm on the IRB as well, and it's very rare that there's a large portion that we expect that the patient to pick up. We don't like those type of studies generally.
And then when a patient comes to you and they're asking about a trial like this, and you know, there might be a good one for them, and how do you balance, you know, giving them sort of the hope of doing that with some of the potential drawbacks or caveats that there could be adverse events, it may not work, or they may end up on a placebo and not on the actual, you know, how do you communicate that to patients, and what's sort of their typical reaction, or and how do you deal with that?
No, it's a great question. I think disclosure is the most important thing, having an honest discussion right around the study. Is there a control arm? Is there a placebo? What are the known side effects, right? Because in the clinical trial, you may discover unknown side effects as well. And then what's the known potential benefit? And so I think these are all going to the principles around clinical research from the Belmont report that Dr. Morris mentioned earlier, things that we discuss in clinic. And, you know, a certain trial may be for a person. One thing I always do when I'm consenting a patient in clinic is have that discussion. I give a copy of the informational consent to the patient, and I say, you don't have to make a decision today. Go home, read these documents, read as much of them as you're interested in, ask questions of your family, patient advocacy groups, and let's meet again, you know, in a couple days and discuss. Because for most diseases, you have a couple days to make the decision on what you need to do next to best take care of the patient. And you want patients to come back in with a list of questions that you've answered so that you both feel comfortable with taking that step forward together.
And I would add, you know, when we're doing a study, it's because we don't know that it works. And so we call that equipoise. That's another term we use a lot. It means that we don't really know if the product of interest, does it work? So that's why we have to, do the study. If we knew it worked, then we would offer it to everybody. So, but it's important that in the design as well. So if there is something like where we really have a strong inkling that this is going to work, you can also change that scheme of randomization. So it's like two to treatment to one of the comparator or something like that to try to make better odds, or the crossover that Dr. Patel mentioned.
I think we've got our first audience question.
Yeah, so I think everyone who wants to be involved in a clinical trial, it's better care. We have to bring more molecular diagnostics to bear. It's really hard to get through the FDA right now without spectacular data. So the bad old days where we could throw garbage into a clinical trial, those days are over. Now that we have precision regenerative medicine, as I'll call it. But also the great thing here in California is standard of care is covered. So a lot of the clinical trial costs are actually covered by standard of care. Sandeep and I were having this conversation earlier today. We have to have a very good idea that it will work to be able to even be able to get into a clinical trial now. That's the fact of traversing the FDA. But I just wanted to ask a question and also make a good comment. We have 9 alpha clinics in the state for stem cell-related clinical trials, and we all work together as directors in the state. We're fortunate enough to have one here, and we have accelerated confidentiality agreements, clinical trial agreements, budgeting, you know, we work together. So that's something that Maria Huaracha helps with. We've got our entire team here to help everyone. But the question I had was, what role do patients play in clinical trials development? And we were having this conversation, Rob, earlier with your community advisory board. How do you think patients should play a role in the development of these nascent clinical trials, and at what stage?
Well, ideally at all stages, right? And it is something that has got some momentum. Studies that have been done in HIV particularly have been trying to encourage that we get the full diversity of the population, having more consultation with the target populations, and then have that even early on before the study starts. And even in our HIV cure study, which we're doing in collaboration with City of Hope, they actually do the CAR T therapy. We have a whole part of that study. They touch base with someone that is asking their experiences, and we're trying to feed that back so we make it a better experience for the participants. So I feel like, I don't know if all studies are really doing that, but that is certainly the direction that I think we ought to be heading.
Well, I'm always struck when I met someone who's on a clinical trial, how sort of altruistic they are about it, right? That they're, you know, you think they're in often a desperate situation, and they're looking for a way to help themselves. And they talk about that it's not just about helping themselves, it's about helping others, right? That they are part of research, and maybe they may not benefit from the outcome of this trial, but maybe other people down the road will benefit from that. And so, I think, and I don't know if this is something you talk to your patients about in identifying their role as contributing to the science and the research and the progress of medicine, you know, beyond their individual needs.
No, it's a great point. Fundamentally, it is about altruism, right? And it's a journey into the unknown together. It's simultaneously putting the oxygen mask on yourself and the person, you know, next to you, and the person who may come ahead. And I think it goes to the point that you don't have a therapeutic misconception. For the vast majority of studies, we don't know if it's going to work or not. It could. And so these are often in settings in which they're not particularly strong other options, or the other options have issues. And so just understanding that there's a potential benefit for yourself as a patient, but also a benefit to the other folks who are in the waiting room with you, or the other folks in your patient advocacy group, you'll find patients are immensely generous. And one of the ways I've seen this is there are optional kind of research blood draws and optional biopsies to better understand the drug. And they're optional. The patient does not have to do them. But about half my patients will agree to do it, because when they understand that, it'll help better refine the drug, and it'll help someone else. They have that sense of community and that altruism. And so I think it's a really good point that you make, that it's not just about the patient themselves, it's about the patients that are currently also fighting the disease nationally and internationally, but the patients that'll come as well.
Yeah, and I'll say, as a research scientist, right, we depend on samples from patients. So even beyond those that are in clinical trials, like agreeing to participate in research is critical for driving the science forward and to bringing new things to trials and hopefully to new cures as well.
Thank you all for your time. I learned a bunch. Dr. Morris, I think you mentioned briefly FDA approval, and I'm curious where that comes into play with the different phases of clinical trials and what that looks like.
Yeah, you know, it's quite a long process to get new products out. You know, there's a lot of science and discovery that needs to happen. And then when it gets to the time when you have to do the preparation to get that investigational new drug to get into prison, there's a lot of other preliminary work that needs to show that there is a signal that it might work and that it has safety already. Usually that's been done in animals, but there's a trend to go to organoid models in the future, so that we can spare animal research. But after that, then you got to get through all the phases of the study. And usually for, depending on kind of what the target is, if there's no other options, like, you know, you have a disease where people have, you know, no other options, and it's, you know, very poor outcomes, Those sometimes can get approved sort of earlier on, even after phase is two. But other ones that are sort of where there's a lot of stuff on the market and you're trying to like, you know, you're trying to make a new hypertensive drug or lipid drug, those are going to need large phase three studies, which would take years and years usually. And then usually there's a pivotal study that is a phase three, and those results then are curated. And in the ones that I participated in terms of as a site investigator, usually within 6 months of the completion of the study, they're wrapping the data up, getting it in, and you'll have an approval usually within that year even for that drug to come out. But getting to that point may have taken 10 years. And so I wish there's got ways to maybe get things faster to market, because I think that's a frustration. If you're a patient, then you want something now.
I think we've got another question there.
Approximately what percentage of clinical trials are not able to go forward because not enough patients are recruited?
Yeah, that's a great question. It probably depends on the disease state. So what ends up happening with these studies is the timelines prolong. But a study that has to close due to a lack of enrollment, at least in oncology, I'm going to have to say is probably about 10% maybe, would be my guess. What's much more common is it takes longer. So you think the study is only going to take 18 months, but because of slower enrollment, it ends up taking 36 months. And so you typically try to just extend it, the amount of time the study's open, and you add more sites to try to accrue to answer the question. And one of the reasons that's so important is to close a study. We talked about kind of what an act of beneficence it is, right, for that patient to kind of, especially for a randomized controlled study where they may be getting placebo, to volunteer, right, and to be a participant. So to close a study earlier kind of and not get an answer kind of takes away from that. And so you want to answer the question not only for the importance of the science and the patients that may come, but for those that volunteered to do the study in the first place. And so typically you're more likely to extend the study rather than close it. But some studies, they're niche, you can't find patients for, there are operational issues. Those may get closed. The other reason studies sometimes get closed is rather than waiting till the end of the game, they'll do a halftime kind of interim analysis, especially for certain types of studies, to make sure we're not exposing so many patients to a drug that isn't working. And so there are different ways these are kind of navigated in real time with the goal of minimizing the number of patients get ineffective therapy, but also trying to avoid patients being in a study for no reason.
Very informative, and thank you for making that a series, because I was in the other webinars and meetings too. A question from a sponsor side. Since this is a stem cell clinical trial, I would assume that you're also looking into NK cells and dendritic cells. And if we would have such a trial, we would contact you, Dr. Patel, or go directly to the cancer center, because we need to know what kind of cancers you have. We envision a basket trial, meaning a lot of different solid tumors and
yeah, it's a collaboration for these studies. About half the clinical trials in that chart I showed are cancer related, anywhere from a third to half. So yeah, definitely feel free to reach out. Happy to talk after, and we'll get you to the right folks. We have inpatient service, of course, where these patients are treated, an outpatient clinic, but then you may want some disease-related expertise, which we have at Alpha Clinic Experts Group, across different tumors, across different diseases as well, that we can connect you to.
And you don't need a CIRM grant for that? It will be venture-funded?
Yeah, mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah.
I think we've got one more.
Yeah. How do you get doctors and medical institutions to adopt a promising product at scale, like once it reaches like FDA approval?
Well, it depends on, you know, who's making it, but generally, you know, that becomes, so actually when you're paying for, you know, how expensive drugs are these days, right? And we hear about that. A lot of that is the advertising and promotion of their product that they're paying for. So it often comes as the pharmaceutical line where they're actually promoting that product. But then, I mean, if it's a good thing and there's good science behind it, it does lead into expert guidance and guidelines around treatment, and then it has to find its way into, you know, sort of the algorithm of how we treat people. That sometimes can take time. Sometimes it's faster if it's really a dramatic change. And so that's usually how physicians kind of learn about things, you know, in your medical education, in your practice, that you know, guidance has changed. And then you say, okay, well, that is, and that becomes the practice. And then, of course, insurers have to take it on to pay for it. So there is a bit of a complex game of not just the promotion from the pharma, but it, more specifically, it's getting the profession to decide that that's an appropriate treatment and where it lines first, second, third line, and then insurers paying for it. So that's how something takes, and that can sometimes take a little time to filter into general practice throughout the whole country.
Well, I think we've, you know, started to cover a lot of ground today. There's still lots of room to keep this discussion going, but I do want to thank Drs. Morris and Patel for their time today and sharing their expertise and background. And I think that, you know, we've really learned today that clinical trials are, you know, a bridge from science to treatments, right? And that's a bridge that we all have roles in helping cross, you know, as scientists, as physicians, but most importantly, patients and their families. And so, you know, hopefully this can help us to navigate those and to make that cross together. So thanks everyone for attending or tuning in today, and happy to continue the discussion moving forward.